We'll see you again next month or early next year.
Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching your screens.
Giants defeat Chicago 5-3. Cincinnati beat St. Louis 10-9. Brooklyn whitewashed
We might have been meant for each other.
I only had the money.
It isn't a question of money, believe me, kid.
I could have been on the covers of matchboxes, pencils, anything you can think of.
We're going to have a long talk in a few days, Gladys. In fact, several long talks. In fact, we may end up talking. What do you think?
Let's fall in love. Now, why shouldn't we fall in love?
Gladys Glover. Gladys Glover.
Oh, he's talking about me.
Well, it's the subject for your Manhattan nightcap for tonight. Many New Yorkers are speculating as to the answer to one of the most unimportant questions of the day. Namely, who or what is Gladys Glover?
Did you hear that?
Now, signs bearing this mysterious name seem to be appearing all over our town, but it's this department's guess that Gladys Glover...
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee will be holding virtual information sessions from now through June. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of all of our members. BIPOC persons are especially encouraged to apply. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. Thank you for considering board work at KBOO.
Can't get enough of The Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our entire first season, now streaming wherever you choose to listen to your podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe.
While you're at it, check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com so that we can keep you up to date on all the latest with The Ghost of Hollywood.
I'm Grace Gray, Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting Negotiating Dramatic Events, a new show on KBOO, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. I am a social justice activist since the 1960s. The purpose of the show is to make life more wonderful for me and the people around me. And I'm 80, and I'm going to take my elderliness and share what I have found so that everybody can be seen, heard, and understood. Negotiating Dramatic Events, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate KBOO.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast focused on sharing the stories of people who are currently or formerly homeless in our community and helping navigate the systems and services that the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its partners either have in place or are developing to help people move out of homelessness and back into stable, supportive housing. On this episode of Out of the Streets of Portland, we bring you part one of a two-part series featuring the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault System of Care. This system serves survivors of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault and stalking, as well as their children or other dependents. To give an advance warning to our listeners, this episode will contain references to and descriptions of intimate partner violence. On this episode, we'll share the story of a woman who we'll call Jane Doe, a survivor of domestic violence who received support from joint office-funded providers in Multnomah County. In the next episode of this podcast, we'll keep the focus on domestic violence and the sexual assault support system, and we'll speak with some of the providers and staff who help survivors navigate this system to get the help and support they need. We'll mention this again at the end of the episode, but just want to share with you the phone numbers that people who think they may be in a domestic violence situation can call to get some help. The first number is Call to Safety, 503-235-5333. That's a 24-hour staffed crisis line for people in the Portland area. En español, tenemos una línea de crisis, 503-232-4448. Es una línea 24 horas cada día para los sobrevivientes de violencia doméstica y o asalto sexual. Survivors can also call the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services during regular business hours at 503-988-6400 for one-on-one support with experienced advocates who will help develop a personal plan and connect the person with services. Now, we go to the story of Jane Doe, who is now a domestic violence advocate herself, helping other people flee domestic violence situations after having been through the process herself.
I got married, engaged at 17, and married it within days of my 18th birthday to a person who was very controlling. How I actually came to engage in services when I was in my young 30s, I had two kids with this person after being married for 13 years, and it was clear that I needed to leave. And so I called my parents and said, I need some help. And they were kind enough to send me a plane ticket and hire me an attorney to get me out of the state of Ohio. And from there, I began to very slowly engage with services. By the time I wound up in a domestic violence shelter, I still had no idea that I was a survivor of domestic violence. I had no idea what domestic violence actually was. But I started noticing that everyone else that lived in this shelter had an abuser. And I just thought my ex was just a jerk. And I think both things can be true, but I didn't understand that, like, financial abuse counts as domestic violence. Getting screamed at daily is domestic violence. Being physically assaulted, even if it only happens once a year, is not okay. Even if they're sorry afterwards, even if, you know, like, it, I didn't understand the full picture. And so in the early years when I came, I, you know, went to school, I lived in my parents' basement, and we had many, many scary events where the judge just was like, well, he's the dad, he gets time with the kids. And there was mental illness and drug abuse and abusive behavior were all concerns. And so over the years, for the first 10 years that I was here, I think I was in court about 3 times a year with him about various things. And the judge would be very mad at both of us that we couldn't get along. And I don't think the judge ever really grasped the seriousness of the safety concerns.
So you're a young person trying to navigate an abusive relationship, and you're having a judge not take you seriously in that?
And yell at me regularly. Like, he would yell at the whole room that it was ridiculous that we were all there, which I was like, I agree. And he ordered us into mediation. Before I could get to the mediation, my ex showed up at my apartment door and tried to kick the door in because I told him he couldn't see the kids that weekend because he didn't follow the court order. That was immediately followed by a restraining order, which he immediately violated. And then I've been in and out of court with him since that event, in criminal court, you know, probably 9 or 10 times. And at this point, eventually I decided to change my name and social security number to become safe from him, because I discovered that the courts were limited and unwilling to keep me safe and my kids safe. So I literally fled in the middle of the night. My sister knew someone in another in the state I was living and told me, you know, it sounds like you're in a pretty stressful situation. I'm not saying it's going to come to this, but if it does and you need a place to go, you call me. And so I did one night and I said, I got to go. And because you can't get your driver's license renewed with a with children in the car, I had an expired driver's license. So he reported my car stolen, our car stolen, reported that I'd kidnapped the kids. I had 32 screaming voicemails on my phone that night. And the next morning I left Ohio on an airplane and never went back. And then he came out to visit a handful of times, and within a year he was living in Multnomah County, stalking my parents, stalking my family. He's shown up at my sister's house a couple years ago, violated the stalking order, and then got released because there weren't enough public defenders, and he's unable to aid and assist because his mental health concerns are so large that he doesn't it's believed that he doesn't understand the difference between right and wrong.
Wow. So he was released because there was no public defender to defend him.
On one of the charges, yeah.
Wow. So.
Oh, that's the least shocking part. I could tell you more.
And what was he charged with?
A violation of a stalking order. So while he was on probation for violating, so I had four restraining orders. I got one a year until I hit four. And then a lawyer advised me that a stalking order might be more appropriate because it's a lifetime order. And so I got a stalking order with a mile radius, which is very difficult to do. And then he violated that. And while he was on probation for violating the stalking order, he was on an ankle monitor, and they caught him out like a block away from my parents' house looking for us on two separate occasions. And we're unable to convict him. He spent a year going back and forth between the state mental hospital and jail for that. But he didn't have any conviction. The statute of limitations or the whatever the thing is ran out. And so then they let him go. And I finally thought, like, okay, we're in a different state. He's going to leave us alone. But then it really became the thing that we took from him. It wasn't that he wanted to be a parent. It was that I told him he couldn't. And he never really got over that. So it became this crusade of, she took my kids. I'm this great person.
Was he abusive to the kids in addition to being abusive to you?
Eventually. Not in the beginning. The thing that people don't understand is typically an abuser won't become abusive until the kid is old enough to say no to him or them. I use him because we know that domestic violence occurs across gender, race, class. But the survivors that come forward, the most common form is male perpetration against female. But I had been socialized to think that marriage is forever, he's going to be a doctor, it's going to be great. And it starts incrementally, like you almost don't even notice it. And at first he was like very doting, very caring. And as a very insecure teenager, I was like, oh, I love this. He tells me I'm pretty, let's get married. And then it becomes lots of jealousy, lots of financial abuse. He would often not work or go on drug runs and spend large amounts of money. And then an easy way to control someone is to gaslight them. Gaslighting is based on a term from a 1950s movie with Ingrid Bergman, where they used to use gas lights as porch lights. And she comes home and remembers that the light is either on or off, but when she comes home, it's different. And it's a form of crazy making where the abuser will convince you that they're in fact the victim and your behavior is irrational. And had you not done that, everything would be fine. And so as a very young woman, whose family was very far away, it's very easily to get isolated, to, you know, all my friends were not up to his standards, and he would, you know, find a reason to cut me off from my friends. Meanwhile, his friends did way worse things than my friends did. But my only friends that I was allowed to have were his friends. And so you become isolated in a way that it becomes harder and harder to reach out. And by the time you do, the shame of where you are is so compounded and so complicated and frustrating. Like, by the time I left him, we had so much debt and we didn't own anything. It was just from him constantly. Like, he took out credit cards in my name that I didn't know about. I had phone bills coming to my house. He didn't pay child support. After we separated, he hadn't seen the kids in 3 years, and he still felt entitled to take the earned income credit for them, even though he wasn't paying child support. Like, there's all these ways that people can sort of pull at the threads. You know, as a single mother, that job is impossible. And then you have someone who, in addition to not contributing, is just constantly pulling at your threads.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're bringing me to the question I was going to ask about how it can, like, how is it hard for someone who is a survivor to seek help, and that isolation that you talk about?
Well, one of the biggest things for me was the shame. He threatened to kill members of my family if I ever left him. And the shame and guilt of knowing that my coming to Oregon would put them in danger made it very hard to reach out. And a lot of the things that happened, I was unable to talk about for at least 10 years. Like, I started talking about them in open court for the first time. And I remember locking eyes with my mom in the back of the courtroom and just being horrified that she was about to learn what I really experienced. And then I described to the judge, because he was like, I still don't understand why you're afraid. You haven't made that clear. And I said, you know, he has pulled a gun on me on more than one occasion. He's threatened to kill members of my family. And no, I didn't call the police. And no, I don't have any proof, but that happened. And it's very hard for the judge to make a ruling based on that, because there's no evidence, right? It's my word against his. He's a doctor at this point. And I'm just a woman who's trying to get through art school. I think there's a lot of, when you reach out for help, there's a lot of accountability involved, because I think people think that, like, the model of recovery applies to DV. Like, if you just make better choices, if you just be accountable. But what people don't understand is all of your choices have been reeled back to the point where you don't have real choices. And so, like, yes, you did that, but you also felt coerced. And so accountability isn't really what survivors need. They need unlimited compassion and support and understanding.
What kind of support is out there? If someone is in a situation where they feel unsafe, what can they do to get help, at least here in Multnomah County? I know there's a hotline for people to call, and yeah, what happens if they do?
So that question is very complicated, but I'm thrilled to answer it. So we do have a hotline called Call to Safety, formerly Portland Women's Crisis Line, and it is sort of a hub, as well as the Gateway Center, which is a drop-in day center. And those resources can connect you to the next level. What I mean by that is somebody who's experiencing domestic violence could have housing concerns. They could have safety and criminal justice concerns. They could have family law concerns because they have children. They could have immigration concerns because they were either married to this person and now their immigration status is in jeopardy, or maybe they're undocumented and they are worried about accessing a nonprofit services if that's going to affect their immigration status or get them deported. There's all of these different elements that are typically at play. And so there are separate resources for each category. For housing, we have, I believe, 4 local domestic violence shelters in Multnomah County, and capacity is very stretched. You have to have an hour-long assessment in order to even be considered, and then it's still very competitive because of the need. So if you call Portland Women's, I'm sorry, Call to Safety, and you tell them that you're really worried about your safety and you're thinking of leaving, but you don't know what to do and you can't get into shelter, they may, depending on the funding and where they're at in the month, they may offer you one night at a hotel to sort of get you some time to get some space, to get to the Gateway Center the next day to fill out a restraining order or to connect with services. Sometimes if you've been, like if you've had contact with the police or other things, there are programs that can get you up to a week. But I think what we need to understand is that people need months of time to get all of their things handled, to find a new place, to get their income straightened out, to make sure that they don't lose their job. And so we're asking people to make wildly complicated decisions with a very, very small amount of support. What we also know is once you leave someone, going back could be more dangerous. If that one night of motel doesn't get you what you need, then you might have to go back and they might be aggressive.
Yeah, and I think the returning to an abuser is something that people who haven't been through it maybe don't understand. It's not always, like you said, it's not always a choice. And maybe you could explain more about why people might return to an abusive situation.
Oh yes. So this is also multifaceted. So we know it takes on average for women to leave 7 to 8 times. And this isn't just because we are flakes. It's not because we are just willy-nilly can't make up our mind. It's because you can make a plan and think that, a lot of people think like, oh, I'm just going to leave and things will be okay. And then if there's stalking involved and they find you, you may have to return for your own safety. You may have to return because they're threatening the people you love and you're worried about your parents or your sister or your pets. They also will sometimes use pets to threaten people. You also may discover that the judge is going to give him time with your kids regardless. And so you may feel like if he's going to be around the kids, you need to be too. And so you need to be with them to be that sort of buffer for your children's safety. You may run out of money. You may lose your job as a result of the harassment. There's all sorts of things that can happen during this time. And we know that it's the most volatile time in a relationship. It's the time that women are most likely to die at the hand of their partner is when they leave. And given the amount of resources and the amount of need, it gets really complicated when you talk about, you know, packing up your 3 kids and you get one night of motel or a week of motel, or, you know, you get a week on your friend's couch and then he shows up and puts their lease in jeopardy. For me, I still have people telling me about the horrible, threatening things he says about my family online. Like, it has never stopped. He showed up at my sister's house 2 years ago. And this has been going on for 20 years. I changed my name and my social security number to get my kids and I safe. But he's always in the background. I've had him call child welfare on me 4 different times. And I had a child welfare person write a report that they were too scared to be in the room with him. But I was protective, so it was my job to go to court, and they weren't going to recommend he not be around the children because they had one protective parent.
What do you mean protective?
I was actively had a restraining order and was trying to keep him away from the kids. And they were like, if you understand that and you're trying to do it, it's not our job to cut him off. It's your job to go to family court and get a lawyer and cut him off. They only get involved when they perceive both parties as not being protective. Or if one party is has access to the kids. I basically took the point of view, you can't see the kids until you behave better. And so I didn't let him see them for about 9 months. And then it wound up in a child welfare report. And they were like, well, she's not letting him see them, so we're good. But I was at jeopardy of getting in trouble with the judge for that.
Because the judge had ruled that he could have visitation?
Correct. Parenting time.
Without supervision?
In the beginning, and then as more and more things came to light, it became lockdown, and then we joined Safety First, which is a supervised, professionals supervise the kids, and then he eventually got kicked out of that program.
Did you feel like your kids were in danger going to visitation with him?
Oh my goodness, he caused so much harm in those visits. So they couldn't interrupt, and they can redirect, but it doesn't stop him from saying really terrible things. Like one time they came out just sobbing because his parents wanted to see them. And I said, okay, I'll bring them over Christmas. And they told him, Daddy, we're not going to come next week because we're going to see Grandma and Grandpa. And he said, you're the only people who love me. No one loves me. No one's going to be with me on Christmas. I'm going to be all alone. And they came out just sobbing, you know, we can't abandon our dad. They were just little kids. And, you know, the center was like, well, that's unfortunate, but we interrupted it, so it's okay. And I was like, I have to take these two kids home and put them to bed. Like, they're crushed. He also would like jack them up on like caffeine and ice cream. And the visitation was always on a Wednesday. So then I would have to drive across town, do the visitation, drive home, and then get them to bed, and they would just be wired. And I asked a pediatrician, I was like, can you write a letter saying that my six-year-old shouldn't be getting Mountain Dew in visitation with their dad? And the pediatrician was like, I agree with you.
That was a survivor we're calling Jane Doe to protect her anonymity. She received support from domestic violence service providers funded by the Joint Office of Homeless Services in Multnomah County and went on to work as a survivor advocate and case manager. One of the key values of the domestic violence sexual assault system is self-determination for survivors. The work is grounded in a survivor-centered or survivor-led service model, recognizing that survivors know best how to meet their own needs. This focus serves to prevent replication of power and control that might resemble that used by an abuser and is one of the most important values of the domestic violence sexual assault continuum as a whole. Again, I want to repeat the phone numbers to call for anyone who feels they may need help navigating a potential domestic violence situation. The first number is Call to Safety. The number is 503-235-5333. That's a 24-hour staffed crisis line for people in the Portland metro area. En español, tenemos una línea de crisis, 503-232-4448. Es una línea 24 horas cada día para los sobrevivientes de violencia doméstica y o asalto sexual. Survivors can also call the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services during regular business hours at 503-988-6400 for one-on-one support with experienced advocates who will help you develop a personal plan and connect you with other services. You can find more information, including how to get assistance with a restraining order, at the Multnomah County website, multco.us/dv. A full list of shelters funded by the Joint Office of Homeless Services, including congregate, motel, and alternative village-style shelters, can be found at johs.us/shelter. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Out of the Streets of Portland. This podcast is produced by the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a Multnomah County department with funding from the county, the City of Portland, Metro, and the state and federal governments to house, shelter, and provide street outreach, navigation, employment assistance, assistance obtaining Social Security income, and case management to people experiencing homelessness in our community. please subscribe to our podcast to get notified every time a new episode is posted. You can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by searching for Out of the Streets of Portland. And you can find this podcast, along with a ton of information, data, and reports, at our website, johs.us. Thanks again for listening to Out of the Streets of Portland.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio.